First case on our calendar is 97-98 State of Ohio versus Jamie Rydell Madrigal. Mr. Gamso.
Thank you. For the first 10 minutes of the vote, I'm going to do that. Honorable Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, Senator President Masolani. States Supreme Court decided the case of Willie v. Virginia. We submit that Willie v. Virginia answers absolutely the question set forth in the fifth proposition of law, answers in our favor. It's on all fours in this case. The only thing that remains is harmless error analysis. Here's what happened. In Lilly, and in this case, we have non-testifying co-defendants statements to the police admitted in evidence against the defendant at trial. In Lilly, as in this case, the statements were admitted as statements against penal interest under local evidence rule. Such statements from unavailable witness. In Lilly, as in this case, the lower courts have found that those statements were admissible as a statement against penal interest is a well-settled, well-established exception to the hearsay rule. The Supreme Court said no. Confrontation clause purposes, at least it's not. One Justice Scalia said such a statement is never admissible. The other four said, well, okay, maybe it's admissible if that statement has inside itself particularized guarantees of trustworthiness. Not looking at anything outside the statement, not looking beyond the statement to the facts of the case in the statement itself. And they said, okay, in this case, the guy had been Mirandized in Lilly. The man had been Mirandized before he made that statement. That doesn't make it more credible. If anything, that makes it less credible. They say he knows he's in trouble. In this case, in our case here today, Christopher Cathcart, the declarant, had been Mirandized. In Lilly, the statement was made in a question and answer session with the police, answering their detailed questions, their leading questions. In this case, the same thing is true. Chris Cathcart's statement is indistinguishable from the statement that the Supreme Court said that Willie violates the Confrontation Clause of these cases. The question then became, in Willie, what to do? And the court said, well, what we do is we're going to remand it to the Virginia courts for them to conduct a harmless error analysis. Is the statement harmless beyond the reasonable doubt? This court, I suppose, could do that and send the case back to the court of common pleas for harmless error analysis, or make the analysis itself. If you conduct the harmless error analysis, then you have to look for the rest of the evidence. Yes. Madrigal was convicted based on four pieces of evidence. We get right down to it. There was Chris Cathcart's statement taken out of the way. There is the fact that associated with him at the time of his arrest was a gun, which may or may not have been the gun involved in this case. Experts can't say. And some clothing, which looks kind of generally like the clothing that three of the five eyewitnesses said he was wearing at the time, and the other two said it's not the kind of clothing he was wearing at the time, and which is not all that distinctive anyhow. That's essentially not worth much. You can't convict somebody based on that. There's the fact that days after the crime in this case, Radical was out of town. He was with family and friends in Fremont. He was arrested at the home of Fred's in Cleveland. The state says that's flight. That suggests he's being out of town. It's hardly convincing evidence of guilt. What you have left, what I expect the prosecutor will stand up here and tell you that you have left, is eyewitness identification. So let's talk about the eyewitness identification for a minute. There are five eyewitnesses to the crime, or portions of the crime. Five eyewitnesses who made statements to the police describing the person who committed this crime. Five eyewitnesses, not one of them in their statements to the police, said this person had facial hair. Madrigal incontestably exposed his photographic evidence in the record. Madrigal had a beard. Chris Cathcart did. Madrigal did. Of those five eyewitnesses, one of them said he told the police, I probably couldn't identify the person again. And the police never asked him to. Never took him to a lineup, never showed him a photo or anything. Wasn't asked to identify him in court. Another one, Brian Conley, did make an in-court identification after seeing this matter on television. Yet another, Kerry Tracy, picked the wrong guy out of the lineup. They had arranged for a lineup, Manuel was not in. They arranged it to check out, see if anybody could identify this one guy. That's the guy Carrie Tracy picked out. She then started backing away from that identification.
She's the one who thought she had to cue someone in the lineup. I thought there was one of them who believed that he or she had to select somebody from the lineup. There's a lineup, somebody, the defendant is there. Is that true? So that's how she had.
That's the person we're speaking of. She did pick the guy out. She later said, very quickly thereafter, said, well, no, I'm not really saying it's him. I thought I had it closest. And yet she backed away from the identification. What I think is interesting is that she picked the guy that the lineup was set up for. In any case.
Well, she made both an out-of-court identification and an in-court identification, did she not?
There was an identification from a photo array and an in-court identification. She was also hit over the head with a gun, she said, by whoever the criminal was.
That'd give you cause to remember, wouldn't it?
Well, it kind of shook you up and interfered with your right election.
How about Corbett's identification?
Next one on the list. He did pick the defendant from a photo array. He did identify him in court. Yes. He's also the one who stared at the man's face. He said, I studied his face, and I couldn't tell whether he had a beard or a mustache. And then there's Carrick, who was with Corbett, who could not make any identification from a lineup or from a photo array, although he did do an in-court identification. What I want to suggest is not that these people It's not the suggestion that these folks had, that their identification is meaningless. I think it's not worth a whole lot.
Well, but both Corby and Caracas also identified the car.
And the car is associated, Cathcart, who had the car, who concedes in his statement he was in the car at the time, is a friend of Madrigal. There's nobody who places Madrigal in the car anywhere near the time, anywhere surrounding this time, except Cathcart.
Well, he left and went around the block or something and came back, didn't he? Or they moved the car or something.
Now, the car was in the same block, in the same place. The person he had seen in the car, they said had originally been, Carrick's reported, said had originally been in the driver's seat, was later in the passenger seat.
And
they
switched.
Saw a second person in the car while sitting in the parking lot. What I says about these identifications? That what we get from them is one wobbly table leg. Well supported. If you have Chris Cathcart's statement, and you believe Chris Cathcart's statement, but if you take away Cathcart's statement, which is what we're required to do, if we take away Cathcart's statement, then we have a wobbly table leg supporting this table.
Well, let's see if that's so. We have the confrontation question, and you say that statement is thrown out because of Lilly. You say there's only one other thing left, and that's the identification of all these people, and you say that that's the wobbly leg. Isn't there a third one you're missing, and that's the gun?
And so, as I said, the thing about the gun is that we don't know anything about the gun. Is arrested several days after this plea. In what purports to be his belongings is a gun which is not inconsistent with the gun that was used in this case. Is it the gun that was used in this case? We don't know. Is there anything particularly distinctive about the gun that was used in this case? Apparently not.
Witnesses thought so. They thought that was the gun.
They said it looked similar to the gun. There was one of them who said that's the gun. The police ballistics expert, Josh Frank, said this could be the gun. I can't say. They can't say. We have a gun which may or may not be the gun. What I'm suggesting is not that if you take away Chris Cathcart's statement, it is impossible to convict Jimmy Madrigal. I am saying that what the law calls for is for you to determine whether Cathcart's statement is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. What I want to suggest is that there is a reasonable doubt that when you take that statement away, this case is wobbly enough. Wobbly enough that what you must do is remanded to the trial court for another trial. That absence of statement, case just isn't strong enough to stand as it is. That what is required, reversal and remand for a new trial. We're not talking about letting that. We're not talking about letting that go off. We're not saying he should be sent back out onto the street by others. He sent back for a new trial. The comports with what the Constitution demands.
Wait a minute. On that basis, it sounded to me like your argument was going to go that there has to be an acquittal. If you send it back for trial, and you want us to say that the statements are not admissible, that the identification testimony is suspect at best, the gun is not identified as the same gun, what are you going to try him on? He was in the neighborhood?
You're going to try him on the identification, obviously, and let the jury decide the identification without the buttressing fact of Cathcart's statement. You're going to let the jury determine whether or not the gun is probative of much of anything. The question isn't, can he be convicted? That's not the question in front of you. This isn't a sufficiency of the evidence question or a manifest weight question. This is a question that says what we do is defer to the jury when we can't say that this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Not when we can't say that this isn't, that this absolutely requires reversal. I'm making the argument that I think the case isn't that strong. Because what I'm trying to emphasize is that it isn't. But that doesn't mean you can't get a conviction. Sure you can. People have been convicted on evidence that I or you individually, collectively, might find unsatisfactory, but that's a jury call. It's not up to me to decide what the evidence, whether in a properly tried case, he could have been convicted. convicted, because that's not the question. What we have is constitutional error. The question is whether the admission of the evidence is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what I suggest to you. It's not in this case.
Before you finish your argument in Maine, are you going to discuss the Brooks issue?
I'm happy to discuss the Brooks issue if you like.
I would think.
Or actually, the two-part issues, I guess. I think that we have the Brooks question, the unanimity question. The court was asked to give a Brooks instruction, specifically. It gave an instruction which says, well, you got to be unanimous, and if you're not unanimous, you're not unanimous. And unanimity is not the same, I would submit, as saying what this court said trial courts should do in the future, and this case was tried in the future, which is tell the jurors that one of you, individually, vote a single juror, get to a life sentence.
Do you really believe that the trial judge's instruction on that issue varied substantially from the Brooks standard? Sounds to me, you know, when you read them in context, set one, as I did, one side by side, to me they say the same thing. Where have I missed it?
It seems to me that when you talk in terms of human error, when you tell a jury about unanimity, what you're talking about is a collective obligation. And the essence of Brooks, as I understand Brooks, is the importance of the individual obligation. It is the difference between what you as a collective body, this jury, must do, and what you individually as jurors must do. And while certainly we ask the jury to be unanimous, what I understand you to have said in Brooks is that the need to emphasize the individual responsibility of each juror is paramount in a capital decision, and that one juror standing alone can make a difference. And I think it's interesting to put that in the context then. That was our tenth proposition of law. It's kind of interesting to put that in the context of the 14th. Where we address the question of the court's telling the jury that in order to return a life sentence, and the court sometimes got it right, got part of it right. The court said in order to return a life sentence, you must find that the mitigating factors outweigh the aggravating circumstances, and that's clearly wrong. Equipoise will return a life sentence. So what we have here, I would suggest, is a combination effect of telling the jury, on the one hand, you have a collective responsibility, and on the other hand, getting the burden wrong. And when you do that, when you put those things together, when you look as you're supposed to at the instructions as a whole, it seems to me that we have a situation where the juror's individual responsibility is diminished, the Brooks issue. And then they're told to weigh it wrong. I would suggest then that what we have is a case where the instructions are thoroughly flawed in the significant portions telling the jury how to do their job, how to weigh, what they must find, how they must do it collectively. And that when we tell them that, we have a situation where, for this court to say that the jury's verdict should stand at mitigation, it becomes necessary for this court to hypothesize a jury verdict, which is precisely what the Supreme Court said you can't do in Sullivan.
Let me ask you a procedural question, if I might, please. Under the rules, under the law, this case was tried. You know, we had the original death penalty statute, and then we had the constitutional amendment and the resentencing sections of that. Supposing a majority of this court found a Brooks violation, what happens then? Because we're just talking about the penalty phase now.
It seems to me that under the new statute, this case could be sent back under penalty phase. If what you determined was solely that there was a Brooks violation, you could remand the case for a new penalty phase.
With a different jury?
I say yes.
Okay. And all they would hear is what is admissible, of course, in the penalty stage, and then the trial judge would take it from there, as you would in any other case.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it would be a longer penalty phase than a typical case, obviously, yeah. Because the jury would need to...
That's my point. You start all over. You have to start all over.
Well, there's stuff that's admissible at the trial phase. You know, at the mitigation phase, in this case, the state reintroduced certain evidence, but did not attempt to bring back evidence regarding things that were not directly related to the aggravated circumstances.
Yeah, but that jury had already heard all that.
But what I'm saying is that in a retrial, you wouldn't have to bring in all those other things either. So there's a set of things that wouldn't come in. But, yes, it would be a rather... To the best of my knowledge, there has not been one of these in Ohio under the new law.
That's why I'm asking you, because a cautious prosecutor, I think, has to start over, has to introduce everything.
I would say they would have to reintroduce an awful lot.
Okay.
Not everything, and I suppose they'd be the ones to answer that, but they know what they would do. Whatever time you may have, I'd like to reserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jameson. Mr. Manders.
None of those individuals had ever worked with No, but it's critical nonetheless that he knew the closing procedure, that he knew that the closing manager would have the combination of safe, that he knew that there was a safe, that he knew that they would put excess flow, because, and he stressed this to the jury, that one of the first things he said after involving that last conference, and after instructing Mr. Armstrong to get the money to put in the down sack, was, who's the closing manager? That's what he asked. Who is the closing manager? The only reasonable inference is he knew that the closing manager would have the combination. In fact, when Ryan Conley said, I don't know the combination, he said, well, why not? If you're the closing manager, why don't you have it? Well, he was a closing manager in training, and Mrs. Fisher was the one with the combination. He certainly had the opportunity commit this crime. We introduced testimony from friends of his who said that he was at their house from approximately 7:30 to 8-ish, and he was back around 9. This offense took place approximately 8:20. This house was in relatively close proximity to the KFC. He certainly had the opportunity to get there, do the crime, and return home. He had the motive. We had testimony from his friends. I think some of them were actually his witnesses that he called to say he was having mind problems. He was out of work.
Could you have convicted defendant without Cathcart?
Yes. Yes.
Because that's really the issue to me now.
Yeah. And it is, Judge, and Justice Douglas, and as I thought back, as I remember an argument I had when we were on the Sixth District Court of Appeals, and the issue where we were debating over whether this certain piece of evidence was admissible, and you asked, you know, Mr. Parsley, didn't you have it? Now, why did you even bother with this? I remember thinking at the time, I said, you know, when you're in trial, you become a little myopic, and you never know how much is enough until you can step back and look at everything from a distance. And I think when you step back and look at this from a distance, a little bit of hindsight, and when you understand and you go through Cathcart's testimony, there was only one thing that he testified to that was not from any other witness, and that is he knew beforehand on his way to the Kentucky Fried Chicken that he was going to be robbed by Mr. Madden. Everything else, there's a listing of some 26 items that were corroborated by other witnesses that he testified to.
Well, but he knew, Cathcart knew where they had parked the car. He knew what kind of car it was, where it came from,
yep,
where he was sitting.
And so did Carinas and Corbin. Those are the two gentlemen who went through the drive-through, that swung around the building as he saw through the drive-through window. They saw that car parked there.
Yeah, they're the people who went around the block and came back, aren't
yes,
they? Yeah.
They actually went behind the alley, was backed up against the fence to try to see the license plate number. They saw a cab car with this skull cap or stocking hat in the car. They described this, what was a relatively unique car, because it was a 75 Buick with Prager mags, mags from the 70s, the Landau top. They testified to all that. And if you step through everything that he said, that, it was that and the fact that he had approximately $300 after. So there's only two things that no other witness testified to.
It's because the car testimony is only evidence that that car was used to rob and kill the person that, but the issue is whether Cathcart was, that's the subtle, the underlying question here is whether Cathcart's telling the truth.
Well, absolutely. Anybody could have been in that car, but you're absolutely right, which brings us to, I think, the identification testimony, which is critical, because we had five separate people identify him from five different points of view, using five different identification mechanisms, if you will, and they all gave five positive identifications. And
except for the facial hair. You know, somebody asked me tomorrow if Mr. Mandros argued a case today. And I said, well, I forgot his name, but I can describe who argued the case. I probably would tell them that the person had a mustache and a beard. What's the significance, and you comment, Mr. Brief, I'd like to hear your comment here. What significance do you place in the fact that none of the witnesses commented on the fact that the person they identified had facial hair?
Chief Justice, I would respond this way. If you had walked into that courtroom as you tried the case, you would have seen me. So that is, Mr. Madrigal cannot grow thick beard. And at trial, he had hair from his chin up to his temples. And I probably could, if I had taken the time, I could have told you exactly how many hairs he had, because you could count them. And at the time of this offense, he had some hair on his chin and on his upper lip. The fact of the matter is, he's an African American gentleman, and his hair just did not stand out.
It's not a contrast, is it?
Absolutely not. And there was also in the evidence a driver's license, some kind of identification card that he had taken shortly before this, that shows the little hair on the lip, the little hair on the chin. He did not have, no, none of you would say he had a beard like I have a beard. No other reason why he's going to be great. But he just, it isn't that type of facial hair. There's nothing at all distinctive about it that would cause anyone to say that is a marker that I am going to use for the purposes of future identification. The point of fact, Mr. Grievous, one of the two of the drive-thru, did testify that he had a bit of a sluggishness about him that he described as looking like he had not shaven for a few days. And that's the most accurate description, I think, that you would find. But these identifications took place in a brightly lit restaurant. We've all been in similar restaurants and know what kind of harsh light they have there. Mr. Conley and Mr. Armstrong saw him initially. Neither of them. And it says in the record how upset these young people were at the time. Conley and Armstrong were 18, Tracy, Harry Tracy, 16, their friend. The shot in the head was chaotic. It was difficult to get any information from them at the time. Armstrong and Conley said they didn't know if they could identify him. They just wanted to get out of there. And they were not shown any photo arrays or any lineups, and it wasn't until court that they identified him. Carrie Tracy, it's a different situation. She went to a lineup. She did think that it was her obligation to identify the person who looked most like the man. And she picked out someone, Mr. Jordan. She immediately told the police to tell her, that's not the guy. He's shorter. The complexion's different. But she did identify him and pick him out of a photo array and took him, identified him in court. A crucial identification of this young lady, not only as to the type of hands, but that she saw that there were slits on the cuff. But she could see that because the fixtures did not go toward the ceiling in KFC. They're up on the legs. And if she was down, she could see them walk around, and she saw little slits, actual crimson sliced cuts on the cuff. And a friend of Mr. Magnus in his portion of the case testified that, yes, he liked to do that because he liked the way it fell over his shoe when he cut it that way. So she gave very detailed information. Mr. Corbett saw him at a distance closer than I am from the bench as he came out the back door looking straight in the eye. There was an overhead light in the back. And perhaps the best witness was Mr. Karikas, who, as Mr. Gamza said, wouldn't make an identification from the photos. And Mr. Karikas is a big bear of a man. He shaved at 1 o'clock. He looked like he needed to shave at 4 o'clock. He's just like the picture in Iron Worker, which is what he was. And he broke down on the scene. And he broke down at the time of this offense because he's the one who went back and discovered Missy. And he said, when asked, why didn't you pick him out of the photo? He said, well, because the matter was too important. photo arrays anymore are done by computer-generated pictures. And while they're good, they're not like photographs, not like the old mug shots. And he testified that he knew what was going on. It was too important to pick someone out from a picture like that. And so he did not. We didn't know until he got into court whether he would identify Mr. Madrigal, and he did. So we had five different people, five different points of view, identify this man. In addition, he said, it's not quiet, it's out of town. The night this happened, the very early morning hours of the next day, Mr. Madrigal finds himself in Fremont at his half brother or stepbrother's house. In the middle of the night, knocks on the door, asks if he can come in, assist him while he answers, falls asleep on the couch. Later that day, he finds his way to Cleveland. We argue that that was right.
Yeah, are you going to comment on the first issue? I know you've argued later, but I'd like to hear your opinion on examining the judge's overall instructions and you believe that this applies for overall instructions with compliance with the book.
Your Honor, I think that clearly it does, because Brooks says that the court should give instruction for the client. The court never said you must give this instruction. He never said you shall give the following instruction word for word verbatim. He said you should. And I can only infer that the court decided that way because of all the circumstances that come before you, you could find yourself in a situation, and you have since Brooks ruled that there are cases when you look at the instructions from their entirety, and you look at the overall reading of the instructions, that they represent a fair rendition of the applicable law, and it does not amount to reversible error. The court said at page 247, if you do not unanimously find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, and it goes on. But that is the key. That's the essence. That's what the jury is charged with finding. That is what the court instructed this jury to do. This was not a situation where, in cases that you've had before, where the court continuously misinstructed the jury, because this court did not. This is not a situation where you've had some cases where the actual jury form gives an incorrect rendition, and yet you found that not to be prejudicial error. That did not happen in this case. This was not a situation where the lawyers from the state or on behalf of the defendant were arguing the wrong standards, whether it was in voir dire or in opening or closing argument. The court did candidly make a misstatement, saying that the mitigating factors outweigh the aggravating circumstances, then we should go along with one of the violence. But I think what's key and what's central and what's important is that you look at these instructions as a whole, you look at them in their entirety, and I'm confident you will find that they're not prejudicial to this defendant, that this is not a situation where the evidence and the issues were equal foils. When you look at these factors that he raised in mitigation versus the aggravating circumstance of this case. And I think it's, if I can touch on the mitigation evidence, I think it's important to note that this defendant called a Dr. Lane, who was a psychologist and gave testimony in this case. Excuse me. And his own witness called Mr. Madrigal callous, that he likes to dominate, that he may lash out if he doesn't get in his own way, that he doesn't feel constrained by rules or laws, that he has a knee-first attitude, and that the defendant was responsible for his own behavior, causes his own mistakes, tends to break the rules, but there is no evidence of any obsessions, paranoia, psychosis, he was not anxious, but that Mr. Madrigal, he found, was a competent person, that he was a correct person, not suffering under any delusions. And that was the mitigating evidence in this case. In part, I think maybe the other matter that was raised was his age. He was 21. And I think it's clear why the jury came back from the penalty phase in less than an hour. Because there was nothing mitigating, to speak candidly, for them to even have to weigh against the aggravating circumstance of this man, who, because this 18-year-old girl was too nervous and crying and upset to get the combination of the safe open, put the barrel of a gun to the top of her head and pulled the trigger. I would also like to talk about two more items. I'm not sure how much time I have. Defense has argued that counsel was ineffective for failure to call an expert on eyewitness identification. And we argue in our brief that courts have held that and such an expert is not necessary, it's not an effective assistance accounted for. Defense counsel will rely on cross-examination to bring out the same issues. But I think it's important to note that it's purely speculative what such an expert could add to this equation in any event. We don't know from the record. For all you know, the defense counsel did contact and consult with such an expert. And that expert may have said, well, you know, I can help you with witness Armstrong and Conley, but I tell you, the state's going to turn me into their witness when I start talking about Terry Tracy, who saw this individual not once but twice, because he came in initially, kind of case adjourned, if you will, looked around. She asked him if she could wait on him, and he said no, and he turned around and left, only to return a few moments later. That expert could have said, I'm going to hurt you when it comes back to someone like Griegas, who was conscientious enough to refuse to make an identification from photos because he thought the matter was of too much magnitude. I'm not going to help you with Orbit, a song from a distance of 4 to 5 feet under an outside vapor light as he came out the store carrying the KFC bag. So that's purely speculation on anyone's part to wonder why that was done or was not done. And finally, if I could talk about his first issue, that the leave to file something. And I say something because it's our understanding, and I recollect that the defense, they filed a motion to suppress on the eyewitness identification. About a month later, they come back with a leave to file another motion, and they withdraw the request. And they sealed some information with the court, a document which purportedly gave their reasons, their trial strategy, their thoughts as to why they wanted to withdraw that. We had asked that we have access to that so that we could adequately address that issue for this court. We didn't get it, and we suspect that the answer to the question as to why they withdrew it is in there. But additionally, I think it is speculative to jump off of the point of withdrawing that motion to what it would have dealt with, whether it would have been successful, and in point of fact, it did deal with the gun, and I would argue that it wasn't prejudicial, even if that gun had been suppressed, as Mr. Danzo argued, no one could say, they had an expert, the defense had an expert, neither one could say that this, in fact, was a murder weapon. It was a 38, she was killed with a 38. And that evidence is critical because in his clothing, the pocket of the jacket, we found a 38 bullet, similar in type to what was used in this case, not identical either, but similar in type, so that even if you take the gun out of the equation, you still have that bullet. It was a 38. She was killed with 38 as well. Can I address any other issues? Try to answer any other questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Mendez. Mr. Danzo, you saved almost 9 minutes of your time.
I'm going to try to run through this quickly in turn. The trial was so pissed. The defense theory at trial was that Madrigal was the wrong guy. And that was the basis of the defense to go say he got the wrong guy. It wasn't an alibi defense, it was simply can't prove it. The implicit claim, not explicit, but implicit, was that Cathcart was the right guy. That he was the one who was actually in the KFC, he was the one who actually did this crime. One of them specifically says that, in fact, that he has never seen, he's asked, no, I've never shown Cathcart, the line has never shown him in a photo array. A photograph of Cathcart was introduced into that. Cathcart appeared before the jury to waive his Fifth Amendment, or to invoke his Fifth Amendment right to make him unavailable. And that photograph of him was admitted into evidence. Also admitted into evidence was an impolite drawing prepared by the police from statements of the witness and the assistants of the witnesses. The detective who prepared the composite drawing testified that it doesn't look at any weapons from Madrigal. We'd suggest that if you look at that composite drawing, you look at the photograph of Cathcart, you look at the photographs of Madrigal that are in the record, you will see that if it looks like any, like either of them, it looks more like, probably an identity, but more like Cathcart than it does like Madrigal. You'll get to decide that. That's the drawing that's prepared from the eyewitnesses, working with eyewitnesses of the person that they said did this crime. Mr. Mandler said that Corbett and Carrick saw Cathcart in the car. Well, they saw somebody in the car. They never identified Cathcart. They were never shown Cathcart, of course, as far as we know, but they never identified this Cathcart. They saw someone in the car. I don't know who. Cathcart said, if you take Cathcart's statement, that it must have been him, but if Cathcart's inside, he's wrong. In any case, Cathcart's presence in the car is not the issue here. The issue here, you asked Justice Douglas, you asked Mr. Mandras, could Madrigal be convicted without Cathcart's statement? The answer, as I believe I'd like to explain, is yes, it could happen. But the proper question is whether Cathcart's statement is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a different question. It's for the jury to decide whether he should be convicted without it, if it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There are tasks. Mr. Mandras told you that also associated with Madrigal at the time of the arrest, the task was slipped down the side. And it is true that one of the eyewitnesses described the perpetrator as having the task was slipped down the side. And it is true that a witness came in and said Madrigal wore his pants like that. The witness also said, so do all of us. We all do that because it's easier when you wear boots. Lots of people wear boots. There is nothing particularly distinctive about these mats in this world. Let's talk mitigation. The state says mitigation is advisable. It was 21 at the time. And that he's brutal and callous and dangerous. Shorthand for people. Well, mitigation is also that he's from a biracial background, that he is shunned by the maternal side of his family, that he's a victim of physical abuse and abandoned by his parents, abandoned repeatedly, that he moved from school to school to school, that his parents, that several parents, kind of serial parents, engaged in significant drug abuse, locked him out of the house sometimes so they could do that. And finally, there is the additional mitigation factor that was presented to the jury of residual doubt. Now, I know, we all know what Dwyer says. Residual doubt is not currently a mitigating factor in the state of Ohio. It was at the time this case was tried. The jury was permitted to consider residual doubt. The jury was urged forcefully by the defense counsel to consider residual doubt and mitigation. We submit that given proper instructions, there is more than a reasonable probability that the jury would have found, based on all of that, that they were permitted to consider at the time and that was presented to them, that in fact, they would have found that the mitigating factors outweigh beyond a reasonable doubt the collection of mitigation that was offered. And I guess there's one more thing that I want to be sure to comment on here. Because Mr. Mandras addressed the proposition while regarding an eyewitness identification expert. Mr. Mandras said, well, we don't know if they consulted one and what that expert would have told them. And I suppose that in some absolute sense, that's true. But we have incredibly strong evidence that they didn't. The trial counsel was appointed. Trial counsel sought and received from the court in paperwork that is certainly in the record funds for an investigator. They sought and received funds for a mitigation person. They sought and received funds for a ballistics person. What they did not seek and receive funds for, or seek and not receive funds for by motion, was an eyewitness identification expert. Now, I suppose we allow the theoretical possibility that one or the other defense counsel, or perhaps some caring relative of Mr. Magdal, happens to be an eyewitness identification expert on the side, or happens to know one, and just had this idle conversation with him and decided this would be worthless. It seems to me the likelihood of that is something of a stretch. What the record suggests clearly is that they didn't know such thing. At the guilt phase of this case, the evidence is strong. Not impossible. Mitigation phase, instructions. Either way, something needs to be done. This is not how it's supposed to work. We ask you to do something from the beginning. Reverse some piece of this. Follow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gienzo. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.